Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Clara Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of Mother Jones. It is my pleasure to introduce Dan Pfeiffer, author of Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump, which has just debuted a number one spot on the New York Times bestseller list. Congratulations, Dan. Dan, as I am sure you are all quite aware, is one of the co-hosts of Pod Save America and a political contributor on CNN. He was one of President Obama's longest-serving advisors, working on two presidential campaigns and spending 6 years in the White House as communications director and senior advisor to the president. He graduated from Georgetown and serves on the board of advisors of Let America Vote. He is not a fan of Paul Ryan. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dan. Okay.
All right. That's a lot of applause for against Paul Ryan.
What a week.
Yeah, what a week. As they say, what a week.
Yeah. So let's cut to the chase to some extent. Your book is about hope, and given... child detention centers, the Supreme Court upholding the Muslim ban, Kennedy's retirement, and the likely threat to abortion and LGBT rights and other things that are precious. Hope is in short supply right now. Just give me a little bit.
Okay. Like, I'll be honest, today sucked. Today was a hard day because for probably at any time in my lifetime, the core things that we as progressives care about have never been in more danger than they are today. But, and here's the but, and this is what the book is about, which is, and I call it conditional hope. Those of you who listen to the old Keeping It 1600 podcast know that there was a time in my life and I told people everything was going to be okay. I don't do that anymore. But we ultimately control our fate here because we have the tools, we have the people, we have the ideas to win elections. We just have to do the hard work to do it. And so if you were, and I know I see swing left shirts here, I see Pod Save America stuff here. I know that many of the people in this room have already been marching, door knocking, calling, registering people to vote. But if your feet get tired, if you're starting to get exhausted, and you need another reason why we have to win these elections this fall, we got it today. And so it's today. Today is the body blow, no doubt. But it's just another argument for why we have to do the things we need to do to win. And it is always important to remember that as dark as things are, there are more people who agree that this president and what he does are the wrong direction for this country than there are people wearing the red hats. So we just have to get those people to turn out to vote.
Yes.
No.
You know, campaigns and White Houses are staffed by workaholic adrenaline junkies. But even so, in the last few weeks, you've been going on live podcast shows, on a major book tour, and had a baby. How can you hold up, and what can you tell the rest of us? You know, as you just said, we need to kind of pick ourselves up and go back out there. But what do you do to sort of recharge yourself? How do you handle this kind of stress and workload?
Well, as is the most important of all of these things is that our daughter was born a month ago Saturday, and... her name is Kyla. She's amazing. She's working on sleeping more than 4 hours at a time. Brittany Packnett, who is a Crooked Media contributor and really was an activist coming out of Ferguson, is really an amazing young leader in this country. She often says, especially in the Trump era, self-care is important, right? You don't have to live on Twitter all day long, right? You can take a break. Watch a show on Netflix, go to the gym, go for a walk, you know, go on a bike ride. Like we can take a break from this for an hour, recharge the batteries and get back to work. And I mean, that's what I have now. Prior to the daughter being born, that would be sports or something else. Now it's the daughter, which keeps me sane. Yeah. If sleepy.
You know, this is a very fun and enjoyable read, your book.
Thank you.
Which is titled again, Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. I just want all of you to absorb that title, Chloe. One of the things that really comes through is how much Obama staffers liked each other, and in your case, even got married to each other. It feels very like the best of Sorkin West Wing, while the Trump White House feels more like House of Cards with all the backstabbing and viciousness. And I mean, apart from everything else and the policy, just like what is the implication from that lack of camaraderie?
I often describe the Trump White House as the plot of House of Cards with a cast of Veep. I always wonder whether it's like a battle for the Trump staff. Do they hate each other more than they hate themselves? Because it's mildly amusing in these dark times that these terrible people who've made these terrible adult humans who've made a choice to do these terrible things for this terrible person have a miserable work environment. Like, that does make me slightly happy. Like, it gives me joy that they can't look at each other in a meeting. It does have consequences for the country too, in several ways. One, White House jobs are hard. Like, you have to take on really hard, important issues. And even under the best circumstances with the best president and the best staff working together, it's hard. And so if you have the worst president with the worst people hating each other, it's problematic. And like, there is a time when it is going to really matter that we have the JV team there. It's going to, and we haven't had that yet because as we all...
JV feels kind.
I went to a small high school, and so if you didn't make the varsity team, it was kind of a participation trophy. And yeah. So it's like there are going to be crises that are not of Trump's own making, and it's going to matter a lot. If like we're heading into hurricane season, there could be a flu pandemic. We could be dealing with Zika in the United States, and all these sorts of things where you need your government to function, whether you voted for Trump or not, and it is a non-functioning administration right now. And so it's concerning. Yeah, it's not great.
How close were the four of you during the administration? You, John, Tommy, and John.
Well, John Favreau and Tommy and I started on the campaign together on the first day. And so we've been friends for a very long time. I didn't get to meet John Lovett until Obama won the White House and he came in as a speechwriter. He made a very indelible mark, as anyone who knows Lovett, right away. He arrived at work pretty late, and he rode a motorized scooter, which he's now told he did ride a motorized scooter to the White House in 2009, which he now thinks he was well ahead of the curve.
Yeah. He should have bought stock.
Yeah,
in scoot.
Yes. And so we all became, you know, good friends over time, and you know, I don't know that a day has gone by since 2000, or at least probably not a day has gone by since January 2007, where I have not had some form of communication with Tommy and Favreau, because we worked together for so long, and about work, about what's happening in the news, about what's happening in our lives, about what's on Twitter now for the last 5 years. And so we like to think that the podcast... Well, I know this because I have conversations with them. It's the same thing. Like, if we were at a bar or if we were sitting around a table in Air Force One back in the day, it's the same conversation. We just...
Phil, you need to give a little more background.
Yeah, well, we recorded and put on the internet, so...
So after the election, your other co-host decided to form Crooked Media, and you didn't. And I'm curious what your choice was there.
Well, I had another job at the time. I was working at a tech company in Silicon Valley. They wanted to base the company in L.A. I live here. My wife is from the East Bay originally in Fremont. We have her family is here. There are Fremont people cheering over there.
Right.
And I didn't really know what I wanted to do with, I hadn't really figured it out beyond how I was thinking about Pod Save America as one way in which I could get more involved in politics. Yeah. And so they had this vision for this company. They had the courage and the foresight to do it. Tommy had lived here for a few years and he and his soon to be wife moved down to LA so he could do this company. And I was sort of in a different place in my life. This is I'm older than them by a little bit, And so I'm so proud of what they have built and done. And like, it's only at the early stages, and they have a lot of really cool, awesome ideas coming, and an incredible new podcast that's coming this week from Aaron. Is it tomorrow? I think they had to I think they recorded first today before Kennedy, and I think they re-recorded tonight. So that, but that, that is going to be tremendous. They have a lot of great content coming, and it's going to be really cool to see what they do.
When you were writing the book, what was your vision for what it would be? I mean, there's a campaign memoir, a memoir of the White House, and then kind of looking forward.
Yes, all the above. So when I left the White House in 2015, I had the normal, I went through the exit process for White House aide. I got debriefed. I filled out the exit survey. I turned in my BlackBerry and my ID. I walked out the gates. Someone from the publishing industry greeted me to see if I would write a book. And, and at the time, I'd spent a lot of time, I was definitely not preparing to write a book. I did not take notes because should not do that if you work in the White House. And I was thinking, but I couldn't figure out, I wanted to make some contribution to people's understanding of Obama's time in office and in his place in history, in part because I'd read all the books that outside people had written about Obama, like Bob Woodward or others, and it's just like, I'm in the book. Like, I'm a character in the book, and I have no idea what they're talking about. Like, it's a funhouse mirror of our administration. But at the time, I couldn't really figure out what was I going to offer that was a different perspective than someone else. Like, my friend David Axelrod, his book had just come out. I knew Barack Obama was going to write a book. Tim Geithner was writing a book. I didn't know what my unique thing was. And it wasn't until after Trump won, immediately after, in the hours after. Mm-hmm. So Trump wins. I go to my friend Cody Keenan's house, who's Obama's speechwriter, with my friend Ben Rhodes and a couple other people, and we drank several drinks rapidly. Mm-hmm. I went back to my hotel at 3 in the morning. I was in D.C. to do CNN stuff, which was really a dark, dark job at the time. And I crawled out of bed at 6 a.m. and had not, sometimes I tell the story and say I woke up, but I never really slept. So waking up is not an accurate depiction of it. And I jotted down an outline of what a book would be like. And I sent it to because I had been talking pre-election with a book agent who had been trying to get me to write a book, and he had some ideas. And so I was contemplating the idea, but I still couldn't figure it out. So right after the election, I wrote this outline, and I sent it to my agent that morning, and he responded. He's like, great, I'll send this to the publisher who's interested. What's the title? And I was like, huh. And I was like, well, when do you need it? He's like, now. And I was like, okay. So I came up with, jotted down, yes, we still can, with still in parentheses, because that's how I felt in the moment. I wanted to believe we could get past this moment. I then spent a year with my publisher trying to come up with a better title, and here we are. But what I wanted to do with it was in the moment after Trump won, it was the last scene in The Usual Suspects where he sees the board and he's like, oh, I know who Kaiser Soze is. And I sort of immediately saw Obama's presidency through the prism of all these things that I had missed in the election when I told all of you that Hillary Clinton was definitely going to win.
We should have bed wet.
Yeah. Yes. You should have wet the bed. And, whether it's the right wing propaganda machine of Fox News, the spreading of conspiracy theories or the birther conspiracy, changes in media. And I sort of saw, we dealt with all of these things and Obama succeeded despite these things. What lessons from our successes and our failures could I put forward? So I kind of did a hybrid, and I struggled to write it at first. I couldn't find the right voice. Am I a serious person? And I decided just to write it like it was a long podcast. And with that, try to make it, because then I didn't know who I was writing it for until I started meeting all of the people who were coming to our shows. And I was like, oh, these are the people I'm writing it for.
Well, then I have a structural question. It's about footnotes.
Yes.
I don't think I've read so many sides in a book since David Foster Wallace. but they're very effective in that way that it feels like you're joking with somebody who's the other host who isn't there,
yes, almost. Yes.
But that's a really interesting editorial decision, and I'm just wondering, you know,
it was
being an English major geek, how you came about that.
It was my wife's idea. And so my wife is she worked in the White House with me. She's much smarter than I am, and she has the most common sense of any human being I've met. And so she edited this book multiple times. And so I wrote the first chapter, and I had some of the things that were footnotes, but they didn't really – they're hopefully funny asides. And she said, well, why don't you make them footnotes? And so then I sent it – I'm such a knucklehead. And so I took all of her changes, right? Like, she went in there, she fixed a lot of things, she made structural changes, and she wrote a comment saying, why don't you do funny footnotes? And I deleted all of her other comments to send, like, in the course of editing it, before I sent it back, like, some of the things, like, why did you say this? Before I sent it to my editor. But I forgot to delete that one, and so the editor was like, great idea, you should do that. And it also, like, I had read Bill Simmons, who had originally started us in podcasting. I'd read this is a thing he does. My wife does not read Bill Simmons, so it was an original idea of hers, and so she gets full credit or blame for it. But she sends me all of the tweets where people say they really like the footnotes. She sends them to me just so we know whose idea it was.
Okay, well, you can add me to that list.
Yes.
You said that when you were reading Woodward's book or other books, it was like looking through a funhouse mirror. I'm curious if you could boil it down to one or two things that you feel people got wrong and maybe still get wrong about the Obama administration or
sure.
about the man himself.
Well, the fundamental thing that most books about life in the White House get wrong is sometimes it's boring. Like it's not all drama. Like everyone writes it like... Like, so I sometimes read these accounts of these meetings that were, like, so dramatic and, like, filled with, like, people getting angry and scenes. I was like, I was in the room. It was boring. Like, it wasn't like that. And so there is this attempt to try to add drama to some of the basic governing work. But I think the thing that people miss most about Obama the person, and this is what I try to spend a lot of time on the book in this, is he got this reputation early on for being, quote-unquote, aloof.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because he famously did not like to spend time with Republican congresspeople who trashed him all the time. And they was like, well, why doesn't he have a drink with Mitch McConnell? And then Obama once made the joke, you have a drink with Mitch McConnell. Which then caused many Inside the Beltway columnists to take that joke seriously and blame all of Washington's problems on Obama. But he is a very warm person who loves people. And what I think, Michael Lewis, the author, wrote a very long Vanity Fair piece on Obama back in 2014, I think. And he sort of nailed something about Obama that I think most people miss, which is Obama is the least transactional human being to ever have been a politician. And so he, a lot of politics in its worst sense is about transactions. Like, I'm going to let you come golfing with me and then you're going to vote for my guy, right?
Yeah.
And Obama just did not, that's not how he was not wired that way. He thought he was this rational human being who wanted to do things for the right reasons, and he wanted to be around people who did that. But he loved people, and anyone who got a chance to like be on the rope line at an event or run into him at a diner when he was campaigning, is he was very fascinated by people. And I think when his book comes out, I think next year, thank God it was not during the same week my book came out. I think he'll tell some really great stories about how the people he met along the way on this journey influenced him in very profound ways, both as a president and as a person.
You know, he was very good, at least for those who didn't view him through, you know, Fox News, Breitbart side of things, at imparting hope when times were dark, which is, you know, maybe why many people right now really wonder, like, where's Obama? Why isn't he doing something? You know, can't he change something? And I just want to hear you kind of riff on that. And
yeah. So I get this question all the time. Like, why won't Obama save us? Where is Obama? And so I'll give you two answers to this because you said I could riff. At some point last fall, I was in Washington, and I still do some work with Obama's personal office on political stuff, sort of help him do a little, figure out sort of how he spends his time, like campaigning for people and like who he raises money for and that sort of thing. And so I stopped in for a meeting. Obama came to the meeting. It was great to be in the same room with him. And then afterwards, we hadn't seen each other in a few months. So he took me back to his now much smaller office. And we spent like an hour just sort of hanging out, catching up, talking about sort of post-White House life. I walked out of the meeting. I said to all the assembled staff who were there, God, I feel great. It's so nice to hear Obama, to like be with Obama, to hear him speak. I was like, I feel great. And yeah, if he were to come out and give a really powerful stemwinder speech about what's going on in this country, I would feel better. But I'm not sure it would change anything. And so I've not talked to him in a few weeks, so I can't speak to like how he's approaching the immediate things before us, like the child separation policy. But from the years I've known him, he thinks very strategically about where he can have the most impact. And in some cases, he understands that speaking out could have the opposite effect of what we want. Like during the Affordable Care Act debate, Republicans, if Trump was able to turn this into Obama versus Trump battle, that would give Republicans whose votes we needed sort of create a permission structure for them to do what Trump wanted. But if it was Trump versus Trump, that's a different situation. Where I do think Obama can and will have the most impact is in these elections coming up this fall. And so that's why he was out on the campaign trail in New Jersey and Virginia last year, and why he did things to help Doug Jones in Alabama. And so I think you will see him this fall, because that, like, a speech is not going to solve our policy problems. Winning Congress will give us a check against Trump. And so, this is a tough call, and these are tough times. But I think he's trying to make the decisions that he can, where he can have the most impact. Because if he was out there every day just sort of lie, like Trump tweets, Obama responds, Trump tweets, Obama responds, his words would have less impact. And so I think he's looking for
keeping his powder dry.
Yeah, he's looking for the place where he can actually have impact. I bet if he were to give a rip-roaring speech, like everyone in this room would probably feel better, and he might even feel better, but it wouldn't move the country forward in the way we need to move it forward. So we got to find those moments.
Were you, or was he, or were your cohorts surprised at the level of racist animosity that was under the surface regarding him in particular and more generally?
No, I don't think so. Anyone who had sort of been on the campaign trail in 2008 or had seen a lot of things, particularly that some of the House Republicans would say and do about Obama and the way he treated him, were not surprised by it. I mean, I think you're more disappointed in
Paul Ryan.
Yes. I am more than disappointed in Paul Ryan, I'll tell you that. I mean, it is... Should I do this now?
Sure, like, I mean, I think everyone wants a Paul Ryan riff.
All right, so... I really worry I'm on some sort of Capitol Police list now. Like, it's like... this was a choice. Like, being a party that embraced white identity politics was a choice that Republican leaders made. They made it. They had this... there was a moment in around 2009, Obama had come in, and you started to see this very aggressive reaction to a black president at a time of great change and during an economic crisis. And Fox News, more than anyone else, was stirring the pot. And Republican leaders had a choice where they could say something and decry this racism, like John McCain, to his credit, did.
That lady in the town hall.
Exactly, yeah. In the end of the 2008 campaign, where this woman was saying very racist, terrible things about Obama, and he and McCain pushed back on that. And no Republican has done that since that day. That was 10 years ago last week, so it's been a long time. And we should all just remember that Steve King from Iowa, a man who retweeted a Nazi last week. We're not doing the hissing thing, people. every week he goes to lunch with Paul Ryan and sits with the Republicans, and they all just like, they pass him the coleslaw. And it's not, someone on Twitter pointed this out to me. It's not just that they're just like, you can stay in our party. They made him the chair of the Constitution subcommittee. They made an actual avowed, admitted white nationalist, the chair of the Constitution Subcommittee in the House. And that is a choice that Paul Ryan made. He could have done something different, and he didn't. And here, this is the way you end up with Trump is Donald Trump in 2011 launches a months-long racist conspiracy to question the president's birthplace. And then less than a year later, Mitt Romney goes to Trump Tower, gets on his knees, and asks for Trump's endorsement. And so this is how we end up today, and this is the Republican Party. And it's not surprising that it exists in the country, but it is really infuriating that it's embraced at the highest levels of the Republican Party.
Let's spread some blame to the media for a second. I remember Obama pushing back on Fox News pretty early on.
Yep.
And the White House press corps pretty much revolted.
Yes, they did.
Would you just remind folks what happened?
So in 2009, we were pretty tired of Fox just pushing these crazy conspiracy theories. They were basically becoming the pro Tea Party channel. Like Glenn Beck was wearing a tri-corner hat and a wig. Megyn Kelly was on TV all the time pushing this conspiracy theory that the new Black Panther Party had sent scary black people to polling places to scare hardworking white people away from the polls. There was this conspiracy theory that Acorn, which was a housing group, had stolen the election by getting illegal votes from black people. I mean, it was terrible stuff. We were just like, we are tired of this. Like, and the problem was not just that Fox was terrible. It's that the media, in a false attempt or a failed attempt to get balance, was following a lot. They were treating Fox like it was just their conservative brethren, right? Like, oh, they're like us, only slightly more conservative, instead of what they are, which is a propaganda wing of the Republican Party. And so we said enough is enough. And we decided we weren't going to do interviews with them anymore. We publicly attacked them. We called them out for being what they are, that they're not an organization that abides by the strictures of journalism. And the response of the rest of the White House press corps was to defend Fox. And we basically had to wave the white flag of surrender because it was becoming this big distraction because Robert Gibbs, who was our press secretary every time, was just getting pounded from other reporters as if us not giving an interview to Bret Baier was somehow like denying the New York Times from publishing the Pentagon Papers. It was like the craziest thing ever. And then fast forward to 2016, Donald Trump bans Washington Post, these other news outlets from Mother Jones, these other news outlets from his campaign rallies. And what does Fox do? Do they return the favor? Nope. And so I think the thing that keeps me up at night as much or more than the Koch brothers' billions, Russian hacking, voter suppression laws in this country, is the power of the right-wing propaganda machine that Fox is at the front of the line, but it's Breitbart, it's Sinclair, it's everything else that is pushing pro-Republican, pro-Trump messaging and anti-democratic messaging into the social media ecosystem in this country and drowning out progressive messaging. They're controlling the conversation. They are trying, and it boils down to what they're really trying to do, is to make white people scared of not white people, whether that is ISIS, MS-13. You would think from watching Fox that we were on the cusp of a race war in this country, and it's all BS, but it's all to serve a purpose, which is to inflame an elder white base.
I mean, I think what's also interesting is, like, do you think that it is the GOP pushing things through Fox, or is it that Fox et al. Has pushed the GOP in part?
Yeah,
to where
I think that it's the tail wags the dog now. Yeah. If that's the right way to say that. The GOP is not a functioning party. I mean, which is scary because they control all levers of government nationally. But it's just a collection of trolls. Like, all they do is troll. The entire reason for being is to quote unquote own the libs. But what has happened is there are still Republican members, like, I don't know, to pick a random member, Paul Ryan, who like to think that they are these serious people with these ideas. No one cares about their ideas. Their ideas are very unpopular and they're stupid and they don't work. But what Fox does is it pushes them toward, has pushed them Fox pushed the Republican Party towards a party in which Donald Trump could easily win the nomination. And so do I think this is probably the direction a lot of Republicans would want to go? Probably, because they like to win, and this is the way that they won.
Right. Let's discuss the civility, please.
Ugh.
Do you think it's either morally wrong or tactically wrong to refuse Sarah Sanders a meal or to heckle Mitch McConnell?
I have been around for a while now, and I have spent a lot of time in Washington, and I have seen some dumb Washington debates. But I have never seen a dumber debate than this one. And because here's the thing, like, who cares? We are having a debate. Yeah. Who cares? We spent, at a time in which thousands of children are separated from their parents, we spent 72 hours in this country talking about Sarah Huckabee Sanders' access to farm-to-table cuisine. Who cares?
Which is plentiful these days.
Yeah, I mean, you can get it, like, come to California, it's everywhere. But, like, what? One of the best tweets I saw on this, and that's such a 2018 thing to say, and I can't remember who said it, but was what that debate said so much about Washington was that the politicians, the reporters, the commentators, the pundits, they associated themselves with the powerful person who couldn't get the gourmet meal more so than the immigrant and LGBT employees of the restaurant who did not want to serve someone who was dedicating their life to making life harder for those people. And that says a lot. And here's the thing. Democrats are not going to win by yelling at Stephen Miller when he's at a restaurant, but they're also not going to lose because they do it either. I just don't care. Like, what we have to do is we have to vote and we have to beat these people and beat all of them and beat them bad. But, like, and I don't just want to blame the media. I also want to, Democrats handled this so poorly. Like, how could we possibly find ourselves, how did leaders of Congress find themselves on the defensive because a private citizen in a private business 50 miles from Washington didn't serve one person? Like, why did we all have to put out statements that said, like, oh, we must be civil. Civil's right thing to do. Who cares? Well, you know what we should do? Fight like hell to get these kids reunited with their parents. Like, it's not. And Democrats have to learn. You know who does not respond to these things? Republicans.
Yep.
And we should not be like Republicans, except in this one way, which is just because the roundtable on Morning Joe is upset with you, don't change your day, right? Like, come up, like, focus on the issues that matter and don't get twisted around the axle about something this dumb.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Kind of to that point, did you think that Schumer and Pelosi's, like, rather tame but admonition of Maxine Waters was heartfelt or tactical or what?
This is another example. It's like we, like, so much of politics and communications, I talk about this in the book, is about framing the conversation.
Yeah.
And so Maxine Waters said that we should, if she did not call on attacking people, she did not call on harassing people, but we treat like it was framed by the Republicans that Maxine Waters called for violence on Trump staff. She did not do that. But we felt like instead of trying to correct the record, we felt like we had to respond to that framing and decry that incivility in our politics. And I will not participate in a civility debate while Donald Trump is president of the United States. Like, that is absurd. And I think that it's another mistake. I think they were responding to pundit pressure. And I think from the poorly informed political advisors of red state Democrats who are scared of their own shadows.
You know, with Hillary out of the picture, more or less, the right sort of seems to always need new boogie women. Waters for the moment, Pelosi always. And I'm curious where you think that the left and either the party or the larger left positioning on that should be. Like, do you think that Democrats calling for a new speaker if they take back the House, is giving in to sexism? Like, where, you know, what do you think about the whole Pelosi? Is she going to ruin us all?
I think it's just worth noting that Pelosi is more popular than Paul Ryan. And no one... And before Paul Ryan said he was resigning, no one was like, are the Republicans going to run away from Paul Ryan? Look, Nancy Pelosi, we would not, the Affordable Care Act would not be law today were it not for Nancy Pelosi. So much of, I mean, like, she is a badass. She is so good at her job. She's probably the best speaker who has ever had, who's ever held the gavel. And so I think it is, like, Democrats are going to make, individual members are going to make their own decisions about what they want to do. I think there's no doubt that at all levels of the party, we need some fresh blood and new faces. But what I don't want to do is have Democrats feel pressured that we have to get rid of Nancy Pelosi because Republicans are going to run ads. Because once Nancy Pelosi is gone, they're going to run ads about Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris or whoever else. And so it's just like, don't, individual members should make their own decisions. I think she is probably the exact person we want if as speaker to fight back against all of Trump's policy atrocities on a daily basis. But don't be scared of our shadow. Like, we did not lose races because of Nancy Pelosi. And so it's another dumb debate, I guess would be my point.
You know, you said that one of the things Obama did was make politics and governance cool.
Cool-ish. Cool for government and politics.
But can a nominee who's not so cool win? And I don't want to name any names, but, you know, these, not everyone has his sort
of... Who do you think
is
not cool?
Elon and Flair with a tan suit.
Yeah. Don't bring up the tan suit. Look, I think you can, like, is Bernie Sanders cool? I mean, objectively, Bernie Sanders, his campaign was cool. I don't think, I had met Bernie Sanders many times in my life before he ran for president. I did not think at the time that he was cool. Like, that was not my takeaway from my conversation with him. He seemed a little grumpy and pretty serious, but he made his campaign cool. Yeah. He made it, people feel like they were part of something very special, and that people, they knocked on doors, they went to rallies. And that, like, you know, for the Obama 08 campaign, it became... Like, people got together with their friends, and what did they do on Sunday? Instead of going to brunch, they went and knocked doors. They went to the Obama rally or whatever else. And Bernie Sanders did that, too. And so you don't have to, like, be what, like, how I think Obama is cool, and that he just, like, I think he has natural coolness, and he, like, knows a lot about music and movies.
Great
stuff like
playlist.
That. Like. Yeah, he's got a great playlist. But you can make politics fun and cool, and that's incredibly important. And I think that we need a nominee who makes people feel like it is fun to be part of this campaign, because it's hard work.
I mean, I think what's so interesting about this moment is we have all these pop-up efforts, like your guys's thing, you know, Swing Left, the Women's March, I mean, name it. There's just so many efforts that are kind of, you know, springing up, and yet there's no one yet to coalesce around. Do you think that's okay for now?
That's great. I want everyone to run. I want there to be 75 Democratic candidates. I want us to, like, we have to block out a week for every debate. Like, and because I think we, as a party, we have some, I do not buy any narratives to say the Democrats are in disarray and everything's falling apart. I do not think that. I actually think, for the most part, if you don't count this civility debate, the Democrats have done, with very limited power, have fought back pretty hard and pretty well in a pretty tough time. But we have big questions. What does the party look like in the post-Obama era? What is the next generation of leadership? Let's have a debate about message and approach to Trump. Let's have a debate about these big policy issues like Medicare for All, universal basic income, federal jobs guarantee, immigration. Let's have that debate. And let's see where we go. We will be what should not happen is a bunch of Washington types who probably look a lot like me trying to cull the field to some group of electable candidates. No one knows who is electable anymore. Donald Trump is president of the United States. And but there's also the flip side of that coin is no one thought Barack Obama was electable when he ran in 2007. He, after Bush won in 2004, every Democratic strategist, every reporter, everyone believed the only way the Democrats were ever going to get power back would be we had to nominate a straight-laced, moderate white man from a red state. Like, that was it. Like, people were begging Mark Warner to run for president. Begging. 2 years later.
He still wishes they.
Yes, maybe he still does. 2 years later, Barack Hussein Obama from the South Side of Chicago wins the election. And so we don't know. Elections are a match between the person and the moment. And we don't know what the moment is now. We don't know what it's going to be like in 2020. So trying to reverse engineer some electable candidate, because I hear, you know, I was on CNN also pitching this book last week, and someone said, all I hear from voters and Democratic strategists is Democrats have to nominate a white man. That's a crazy thing to say. Like, that is an absolutely crazy thing to say. And, like, let's let the market decide. Like, let's let the voters go out. Let people make their case. We don't know how good you don't know how good a candidate is until they got to go pitch themselves. They got to go to Iowa or New Hampshire or now California to make their case. And so, like, I am optimistic about the future of our party. And I am optimistic. And I believe that we are better off from a primary. And we just saw this in New York. Mm-hmm. Like, these primaries, like, people should be challenging the established order, and we will get, and then we'll find out, right? Is this politician really, can they take that that challenge? Can they succeed by it? And so I hope everyone runs. I hope senators run, governors run. I hope mayors run. If there's an electable dog catcher out there, they can run. Like,
I thought what was really interesting about God, was it only last night when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won?
Yeah.
Was two things. That she, in all of her, at least the ones that I saw post, you know, quick interviews, kind of resisted the call to sort of slam the kind of more established incumbents wide. Mm. And also that the incumbent gave a very gracious, very gracious, you know, sing a song for her. And
yeah, he played, he's he, a, he, Joe Crowley is a great guitarist. Yeah. He played Born to Run for her.
And it was sort of an interesting, because I think, you know, how does the left resist submitting to the Bernie v. Clinton establishment versus insurgent, centrist versus progressive, identity politics versus economic policy divide or divides? Like, that gravitational force sometimes seems artificial and ginned up by, you know,
people on Twitter.
Bad actors,
yes,
and
yeah,
people on Twitter. But, you know, at the same time, those are real debates. So how does the party go forward and kind of...
Well, I think that's part of what a 2020 presidential primary will help figure out. People are going to have a view, and they're going to argue that view, right? And so that's the thing. But I also think this election in New York, where, I don't know if everyone followed this, but Joe Crowley, who many people have talked about as one day being the Speaker of the House, an establishment politician from Queens, who's really not a bad guy. Like, there are,
he's pretty progressive.
Very, yeah, he's not. He's not Joe Manchin, right? And he lost to a 28-year-old who ran a very progressive, incredible race, and people had all kinds of bad takes about that. Like, the Democratic Party is cracking up. This is like the Tea Party and all of that. And what happened there was the better candidate who ran the better campaign, whose issues and positions better fit the district, won. Does that tell us that the entire party is going to change? Probably not. Like, no, we don't know that. But it does say that people should run. If you like this, no one would have ever thought this woman could win if she ran. Like, she was tending bar in the district a year ago. Yeah, a year ago. And she is going to be a star in our party now. And so I think it's great that she ran. I think the party is better for these primary challenges. And we don't have to buy into the premise that the party's falling apart just because people want to run for office. Like, that's good. We're better off the more people run.
So, yes. So many of the questions in here kind of get at two things. One, is there any thing that you can point to that would somehow stop Trump from nominating and getting a justice appointed for Kennedy's spot? Mm-hmm. And I think more broadly, like, what level of completely aspirational policy should we be pushing versus more pragmatic choices, whether that's about policy or perhaps about candidates
sure.
and so forth?
So let's do the Kennedy thing first. So last night, not knowing I was doing another book event, and someone asked me, was there something more that Democrats could have done to get Merrick Garland confirmed in 2016? And not knowing that obviously this news was going to come today, and my answer was not that I can think of. Like, Mitch McConnell is the most cynical human being who has ever walked the planet, and he cannot be shamed into anything. And he, like, there is no legislative mechanism by which a minority can force a majority to put a bill on the floor if they decide not to do that, or put a nomination on the floor. That is the sad consequence of losing the Senate. And so Democrats have very few levers here, but we do have some, right? So I think, so as you're sitting here today, what can you guys do, right? And what can people around the country do? One is we should put pressure on Democrats to fight like hell, to shut down the Senate with the limited tools they have to try to push this nomination past the midterm election. It's going to be hard, but we'll be better off for the fight. We also should put pressure on Jeff Flake, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski. Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins in particular, who are two pro-choice Republican senators who are going to be in the position of voting for the deciding vote on Roe v. Wade in the Senate and or in the Supreme Court. And so we should put pressure on them. And we should also get to the rooftops and scream, every Democrat, every voter, and try to make people understand the stakes here. Because whether it's civil rights, women's rights, workers' rights, everything is at stake with this decision. We have been living in a 5-4 status quo for a very long time in this country, and now that is about to be upended. And so we got to fight like hell. I mean, I want to set expectations clearly that if Republicans decide that they're going to jam this thing through, they may be able to do it. But there are some other things we can do. So here's another thing. And California has done its part, but voters around the country need to double down on gubernatorial and state legislative elections, because we're going to have to pass laws to help enshrine a women's right to choose in this country and access to reproductive health, and whether that's around Planned Parenthood clicks or anything else. And so very few states, I think it's only 17, have actual laws in the book stating that abortion should be legal. And so there are 33 states where if the Supreme Court overturns this law, can automatically make it impossible to have access to abortion in those states. And so there's very real work that needs to be done there. And this is a long-term thing. But I really think Democrats need to get statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico. And because, one, they are citizens of the United States and they should have a vote in the Senate. And two, we need those votes.
Yep.
Cynical, I know, but apparently that's in vogue these days.
So you don't think there's much that Obama et al. Could have done to push back on the Garland, but I'm curious, as another sort of cynical Mitch McConnell ploy of not telling the American public about the concerns about Russia meddling in the investigation, could that have been done differently?
So I wasn't there.
To say reporters?
Well, I think it's important to get the facts straight on this. Like, so I wasn't there at the time, I no longer had my very cool top secret clearance. So all the things I know from reading reporting on it. But it is worth, it is just the very specific debate here is around whether the backstory is the United States determined that Russia was the ones interfering in the election. And they announced that. 17 intelligence agencies came together. Secretary of Homeland Security went out and announced it. It was talked about in the White House briefing room for the whole world to see. And the administration asked, and we also knew, apparently, per reporting, that they were doing it specifically to help Trump, not just to sow chaos. And that was not a unanimous decision within the intelligence community. Some people thought that they could, that that was probably likely, but they couldn't prove it. And so they were hesitant to put their name on. So it was sort of a, it would, like, I think if there was a vote, a majority of people would have said it was definitely to help Trump, but other, there would have been dissenting voices. And so the administration went to the Republicans and the Democratic leaders of Congress and said, this is a huge problem. Could we put out a bipartisan statement saying this to be the case? Because it's going to be, people are going to question it, so we should all put our hands on the knife together. And Mitch McConnell refused to do that because he's terrible. And so I don't know whether that would have made a difference. People already knew, we had already told everyone that Russia was getting, was the ones behind the hacks. It seemed pretty obvious that they were doing it to help Trump since they were only hacking the Democrats. But it was also a problem is the FBI, which was a whole, which was a problem all throughout the election, but that the FBI was telling reporters the opposite. And so the New York Times very famously ran this story right before the election saying, basically talking to anti-Hillary sources in the New York office of the FBI, people who were very close to Rudy Giuliani, that said no evidence that Russia was specifically trying to help Trump. And so that was sort of the box that the administration was in.
Yeah, it's a, I just want to note that that was the same day, because I don't think the timing is a coincidence, that we published our story about the Steele dossier before the election. And so, like, what was going on with the sort of warning signs of the intelligence community, I think, is, historians will sort out someday, I suppose. Fox News' dethroned president, Bill Shein, reportedly has your old job. I would just like to hear your thoughts.
Well, I would say one of the real challenges of writing this book was trying to, like, keep up with events. And eventually I sort of backed away from who knew what was going to happen. There was like months between when you turn a book in and when it actually comes out. So, like, in the Trump era, that's like 100 years, right? It's like writing a book in 1900 and having it come out in 2012. But I did write a section about White House communications and my role. And in everything, I try to tie it to what's happening with Trump now. And I had to rewrite that section 5 times to account for all the hirings and firings of the White House communications director, including, I mean, Hope Hicks, God bless her. She resigned, like, as I was sending it. I was, like, adding a footnote, like, as it's leaving my house. It's worth knowing who Bill Shein is. Bill Shein was the president of Fox News when all of the sexual misconduct findings around Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly came out. And so he was, like, this is impressive. He was fired from Fox News for being terrible, which is like, I mean, like, what is that? And so he's been, you know, he's been unemployed, I guess. And Donald Trump scanned the waterfront of 300 million Americans, and he said, I have this vacancy. Who could I find? He's like, oh, the guy who covered up Roger Ailes' sexual harassment, let's hire that guy. And so it's pretty disgusting, even if he wasn't from Fox. But it does prove what has always been true, which is Fox is now state-run TV. They're just, like, bringing it in-house with Bill Shein. And so these are not great days for my former jobs. I mean,
cluster.
So let's think about this. Like, when I got to be White House communications director, I was so proud. I was like, I have made it. Like, George Stephanopoulos had this job. This was, you know, I felt like I was part of something big. Since then, the mooch. Sean Spicer did it halftime. Bill Shein. When I became senior advisor, my old office is now occupied by Jared Kushner, which I joke means it's now a pretrial detainment center. So, and when you work in the White House, you get access to, like, really cool decorations, like historical things. You can get some things from some museums, and it's a big office for the White House, which is not a big office, but it is, in my view, other than chief of staff office in the Oval one, the coolest one in the White House. It abuts the Oval Office, and it's, you can tell everyone you have the closest office to the president, which just means they assigned you that office, not really that you're that powerful, but people get confused. But it has a big wall across from the desk, and I am told, I have not been invited back, but I am told by people who have been there that where there used to be, I had a framed copy of the Des Moines Register from when Obama won the Iowa caucus, I had some patriotic art, Jared Kushner has put not one, not two, not three, but four flat screen TVs so we can watch cable news in real time with the President of the United States.
No. Yeah, it's dark. What do you think is the issue that would most energize voters this fall?
Healthcare. The fact is healthcare and taxes together, because the Republicans are jacking people's premiums up in order to pay for tax cuts for the Koch brothers and Goldman Sachs. And if that can't fire you up to vote, then I don't know what will, especially when Trump's been running around pretending to be an economic populist for the last few years here, and he had a corporatist policy that's asking average working-class and middle Americans to pay for tax cuts for the wealthiest people in America. Like, that is a message that works. We just have to deliver it effectively and consistently.
What is the best advice that Obama ever gave you?
Well, there's some in the book that is I have a section which I hope you buy the book. If you haven't already, I hope you read this section. But that is the advice.
Yes, we still can.
Yes, we still can. It is available everywhere your books are available. And it is the advice he gave me about marrying my wife. That is I put it in there. Because my wife told me to, which was basically the advice, do what your wife says. But also because I thought it gave a window into the kind of person and father and husband that he is, that I think is great. And this isn't advice so much, but in my first meeting with Obama, the one in where I went to work for him, it was a very interesting meeting. I'd met with lots of people running for office before. They were all the same. It's you kind of want to shower afterwards and walk out. You check the first thing you do, check your wallet when you leave. But they always tell you how they're going to win. They're like, we have this secret poll which shows if only voters in Iowa know about my long history voting for or X, they would support me. And it's all about how they would win, right? I met with Obama for an hour. I never met him before. I knew who he was, obviously, but I had very little experience with him. And this was as he was deciding to run for president. And I walked out of that meeting, having accepted a job, without knowing what my title was going to be, what my salary was, or when I was moving to Chicago, where he had informed me after I accepted the job that that's where the campaign would be. But in the meeting, he did two things. One, he said he never tried to tell me how he was going to win the election. He only told me why he wanted to run and what he wanted to do if he won. And I never had that seems simple, but that's not a thing politicians normally do. And the second thing is he was offering me the job and talking about this campaign that he thought had an opportunity to be historic because of who he was and what his election could possibly mean. He said, how often do you get to put your shoulder against the wheel of history and push? And I was sold at that moment. Like, that's why you do what you do, right? And because all of the other stuff it's BS. I was told I couldn't swear, so it was BS.
The last time you were with Obama in the White House, he talked about a silver lining to Trump's victory. What was that silver lining? We need it today.
So this is why I wrote the book, and this is, to me, the existential question facing America. Are we living in a world where Obama was the aberration? That just this, we had this brief moment of a better politics between Bush and Trump. And that ultimately, this divisive, racially based, Twitter-fueled outrage politics is where we're going. Or there's an alternative, a glass half full alternative, that is Trump is the aberration. And that we are on that ultimately America and its politics will look much more like Obama is in the Trumpism, progressive, inclusive, thoughtful. And that is what I believe to be the case. I believe that Trump won through a set of crazy circumstances and strategic mistakes on behalf of the Democratic Party in massive institutional failure across the board from everyone involved. But we can make our politics more look like Obama. And so what Obama said to me was, the silver lining is that people will finally get a chance to see the differences, to see that politics matters, that there are real differences between the parties, and to see the contrasting visions. And we are seeing that every single day here. And so But what it, like, that's information. So what do we do with it, right? What we do with it is we work our tails off to win the next election. And like one of the great pleasures of Silicon Valley, that's where we are. I haven't slept a lot recently. One of the great pleasures of PodSave America is to get to go around and meet all these people. Many of you, I see your shirts here tonight. And what we see all the time are young people, some of whom didn't vote in 2016, some of whom may have voted in 2016, but really didn't think a lot about politics. They sort of, you know, they grew up, Obama was president, things seemed fine, Hillary was going to win, the country was on a path, and they didn't understand why citizen is an everyday job in this country. And I think that lesson has been learned. And what I hope is that we have a generation of citizens who take that job incredibly seriously, who vote, who run for office, who march, who call, who are going to blow up the phone lines of Congress in the coming weeks about the Supreme Court decision. And that is where I find hope is, you know, is in the people who I met at the Women's March, the people I met at San Francisco Airport after the Muslim ban, the people at the March for Our Lives, the Parkland kids. It's like that America, those people are so different than what Donald Trump says it is, that gives me hope. And that was where Obama found the silver lining, is that we would come out of it, we would survive this moment. And it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt in a lot of ways. It's going to take us years to come out of it. But we'd survive this moment. We'd come out better as a country than we were before. And I believe that is still possible, even on a day as dark as today.
I have time for one last question.
I feel like that was like my wind up. So
I know.
So it's like, this is like when you say goodbye to someone and then you run into them on the corner.
Yeah, totally. But this is a question from a public school librarian, and I can't let that pass. So,
is it how to stock the book?
No. Okay. Yeah. Well, other than your own
I'll be around to answer that. Yes.
Is there a book or an author that you keep coming back to for solace or inspiration?
That is a great question. Why not, instead of that, let me tell you some really great books I've read recently, because I read, no one here should follow this. Do not listen to me here. But I read mostly fiction. And I mean, you can take a break from your fiction to read my book if you want. I would encourage that. And so I try, like, and that is my escape from what is happening in the world. And I'm trying to think, what is the most hopeful book I've read recently? I mean, if you ever read Dreams of My Father by Barack Obama, I highly encourage that. If you haven't read The World as It Is by my friend Ben Rhodes, I highly encourage that. But the best book I've read this year is a book called The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner, which is not uplifting by any stretch of the imagination, but is a really phenomenally written book about San Francisco, actually. And it is really great. And what would be a hopeful book? This is hard. Like, I do watch The West Wing a lot. Oh, here's another thing. Here's a little thing about me. So after Trump won, my wife and I rewatched The West Wing just for to cheer ourselves up. Like, it was familiar, right? Like a blankie or something. But we also watched, during her pregnancy, we watched The Gilmore Girls. And it was made me so, like, I was very skeptical. It was one of these things where, like, we have one TV in our house, and she's not a sports fan, so I'll watch basketball, and then, you know, fair play, so we'd watch something she would like, and so she put on The Gilmore Girls. And so for, like, a while, I was like, okay, we'll watch The Gilmore Girls. And then I'll be like, wait, you watch an episode without me? And so if you want to feel good, watch The Gilmore Girls. That's what I'd say.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, everyone. I'm sorry that we have to go, and I hope that you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, I'd like to thank Dan Pfeiffer, author of Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump, and our audience here in Santa Clara, and those of you joining us on the radio and web. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.